Hi, my name is Con Koutsikas and this is A Cuppa with a Conversationalist, an entertaining, educational and informative program with a broad array of guests with unique perspectives and experiences. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.conkoutsikas.com. Good morning. My name is Con and I am the conversationalist. And as always, I have my latte in tow. And my guest this morning is Gary Edwards. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning to you, Con. And I have my cup of tea sitting right here. It even says so right on the cup.
Fantastic. The obligatory cuppa. Gary is a keynote speaker, consultant, and communication coach. He previously worked as a commercial litigation lawyer and has a long history in consultation with vocational and higher education, having worked with no less the South Australian Police Department. Gary is a certified speaking professional, which is the highest designation award by the peak body for professional speakers in Australia, that being the Professional Speakers Australia. He's a three-time state chapter president and the 2021 winner of the PSA's highest honour, the prestigious Nevin Award, which is for outstanding service to professional speakers and the speaking profession. And if that's not enough, Gary is a professional corporate magician. Wow.
There you go, Con.
Jeez, and that's the program, ladies and gentlemen. Gary, my first question is, where does the magician part come from? And how does that relate? I know you told me not to ask two-part questions, but that's the first thing I'm going to do, ask you a two-part question. Where does it come from? What's the background of you becoming a magician? But how does that actually fit into your work, and do you use it in conjunction with your training?
Sure. So I started doing magic like a lot of kids do, you know, about the age of seven, just with my brothers and just doing magic tricks and so on. And most kids do. Unlike most kids, I kept on with it. I was a kind of a nerdy little kid, and magic is a bit of a nerdy, I'm a nerdy little adult, right, Con? And, you know, magic is a nerdy thing. It's kind of a little intellectual puzzle type pursuit. So I kept doing it, and I did it as a hobby for most of my life. But when I went to university, Con, I actually stopped doing magic for a couple of years because I enjoyed it so much. I thought, I'll never get through this degree. I'll spend all my time doing magic. So, but the interesting thing was that very early on in my life, when you can do a magic trick that fools adults, when you were just a kid but you fool adults with magic tricks, you kind of learn something about the way the brain works and the way humans think and how we perceive things. And so it's been a hobby all my life. It's been a part-time job. I did do a lot of work going out to corporate functions and so on. But it's also kind of been a bit of a social experiment. You just learn a lot about the way in which the human brain works. And yeah. So the second part of your question, I do use it in my presentations. Partly it's an engagement tool, you know, it keeps people interested. Yeah. But largely and I've worked this out along the way, there's a lot of metaphors and there's a lot of meaning in magic that applies to communication.
Mm. You're absolutely right. And for those of you, a gratuitous plug for myself, I'm also a speaking and communication coach, not quite at the level of my guest just yet. However, we do say that engagement and getting attention early on is absolutely paramount. You know, the magic, I mean, most people are always engaged with magic, you know, the sleight of hand, the cards, and, you know, I still haven't worked out how they saw the lady in half, but we can touch on that later on. Maybe if I slip your lazy 20, you'll tell me. Gary, the importance of influence. People say to me often, well, you know, I can talk. Why do I need to communicate better, or why do I need to be a better speaker? What's your answer to that?
Yeah, I find that a lot of people want to be because essentially they're not getting some outcome that they want. And I remember, you know, my first thinking about this was years ago when I realised that a lot of people in situations don't achieve the right results. And when I was working as a lawyer, I'd have clients come to me and they'd have some, you know, argument with someone, and we'd end up going to court or negotiating something. And I found myself thinking, the reason why these people are having a problem isn't because they don't know the law. I mean, they didn't know the law, but that wasn't really their problem. Mm. Their problem was their inability to talk to other people and to negotiate and to, in broad terms, to be influential, to be able to interact with people. Mm. And more broadly, again, I've seen a lot of people, we all have, who you just kind of feel as though, you know, sometimes their life passes them by and they never really achieve their potential. They never really make those connections that that would help them to achieve their potential. Mm. So, yeah, I, from a magic background, I was always interested in conflict resolution. I liked, when I was a kid, I liked arguing with my brothers. this is bragging a little bit, but I remember the brother up from me one day, he and I used to have these long arguments, and they weren't heated arguments. They were kind of clever, like trying to catch each other out, yep, type of thing. Yeah. And I remember him saying to his girlfriend one day, he said, "Don't ever argue with Gary, you won't win." And I was really pleased with myself because my older brother had said this, and I went, "Oh, that's good," you know. So, you know, it's just, yep, that kind of, as you know, Con, in every conversation, there is the opportunity for it to go this way or this way, or 100 different ways.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And geez, that would have been, you would have put that bragging rights, don't argue with my younger brother.
Yeah, that's right.
Put that in there. Yeah. Gary, let's go back some way now. You're a commercial litigation lawyer. Now, of course, everybody jokes about how much money lawyers make, depending on what level you're at. Firstly, what drew you into the legal profession? And then why did you get out of it?
Yeah. So, you know, when you're growing up, you think of things you want to do. Eventually, I settled on either being a lawyer or a teacher. My oldest brother was a school teacher. Mm. I was really interested in teaching, and obviously I now do a lot of training and coaching. I didn't think I wanted to be a school teacher. I didn't know what else there was, but I had that in the back of my mind. And I was interested in, as I said, interested in arguing, interested in ideas, and for some reason, all of that kind of coalesced into becoming a lawyer, which I went and did that, and I really enjoyed it. What I enjoyed most about it, I think, to some extent, was just was just helping people, and also bringing in the teaching side of it. The thing I particularly enjoyed was educating people, being able to tell people what they could and couldn't do, and helping them with it from an educational point of view. How I got out of it? Well, eventually I sort of just transitioned over. I got an opportunity to teach business law at TAFE. They, you know, TAFE uses a lot of external people as casual lecturers. And I remember really enjoying that. And I can tell you, Con, the very first night I ran a three-hour lecture on business law, I went away floating on a high. And one of the reasons for that was, when you're in court, you're putting forward an argument and there's someone else on the other side putting the opposite argument. I remember standing there in a classroom for the first time, and I was telling people things, and there was no one arguing the opposite. And they just wrote stuff down. Now, they wrote it down because it was in the exam, you know. But I just remember going, this is amazing. This is all the good things about being a lawyer and none of the bad things. So there was that attraction, but also I started to get kind of frustrated, and that happened over a period of years. Sure. But I also got frustrated with being a lawyer because it really felt people got to me and it was kind of too late. You know, one of the frustrating things about litigation is you go to court, the best I can do for you is go to court and get some money, you know, a lump sum of money. Mm. And the client's never totally happy with that. But that's about as good as it gets, you know. That, like, I can't take you back in time. I can't change things. And I remember thinking one day that I came up with this phrase, that legal skills are wasted on lawyers. What I meant by that was they wanted me to communicate, negotiate, advocate, etc., resolve conflict at the point where those skills were of minimal use. And I just thought, you know, if everyone had these skills, they wouldn't need me in the first place. So I was less interested in teaching people about what their legal rights were and more in terms of teaching them just how to communicate better.
In other words, how to actually avoid needing somebody to
That's correct.
explain the law to them.
Yep, exactly right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We, I'm fascinated with the legal profession in terms of there's a law, but there are two people who are debating it on either side, and it's never, well, very rarely, I would imagine, would it be black or white. And that's fundamentally a perception. I've a very good friend of mine always tells the story, went to court over a small matter, small claims, no lawyers. People before him, exactly the same situation. They lost. There was an adjournment. They had to go back after lunch with a different lawyer, with a different magistrate. Exactly the same argument. That was over some broken leases in a shopping center. Exactly the same argument. And those people won. Mm. Go figure.
Yeah. And I've been in similar situations. And I mean, it is obviously it's always people, you know, magistrates are people. So everyone has a different view. But I've been in a very similar situation where I was a solicitor, and then we had a barrister who was your representative in court. And we thought we had a good case. We walked into the courtroom. We saw who the magistrate was. And we said, okay, we need to settle this case now.
Plan B.
Plan B.
Plan B real quick, Plan B. Gary, what do you see? Obviously, social media has, from a communication perspective, it has just completely changed the landscape. My son is a school teacher, and some of the things that he says to me and some of the things that I see out socially, you know, you go out to dinner and there's couples who don't take their eyes off their phones and they're eating at the same time. Back in the old days, we had a telephone. You used to actually put your finger in to dial,
yeah,
you know, pick up the phone. What do you see in the way that you teach, perhaps from 5 years ago, or let's say 10 years ago, go back a little bit further to now? What do you see differently, and what have you developed that you had to do differently to get your messages and points across?
Yeah, I think to some extent I've been a bit lucky in that most of the people I talk to are, you know, they're in the sessions and they're not sitting there on their phones. They're typically a little bit older, perhaps. Mm. They're in, you know, management, middle management kind of roles. Mm. But I have had a number of sessions where I've worked with graduates, university graduates working for government departments, and they sit there and I would have a workbook, and one of the things I have in a workbook is I have plenty of blank space for them to write their own notes, and partly because that's a good teaching tool. You know, when people write stuff down, they learn it better. Mm-hmm. And they sat there and did nothing. They wrote nothing down. And I said to a friend of mine who's a psychologist who specialises in younger people, I said, you know, why didn't they write it down? And she said, A, you didn't tell them they had to. They're used to being told. And I'm thinking, well, you know, these are uni graduates, surely. B, they think that when the time comes, they'll be able to just Google it on their phone. So, you know, they don't want to learn in the sense that you and I learn. It's more instantaneous access to knowledge. All that they need to know is in their phone. Now, the problem with that, Con, was we were talking at the time about how to deal with difficult customers. And when you've got a difficult customer, they're not going to wait while you Google something on their phone. You know,
yeah. Just excuse me, madam. I just want to Google conflict resolution.
Yeah. So, you know, I make a joke about what you said, that people sit there at dinner and, you know, everyone sits around on their phone. And I just say, well, it just means you've got to be more interesting than their phone, doesn't it? But phones and all social media, you know, they are psychologically set up to be more engaging for people. It's like poker machines, you know, they are psychologically set up to grab your attention. And social media is the same. And here's a really interesting thing that you'll relate to, Con, being both of us men of a certain age. I was at Marion Shopping Centre once. I was sitting in a coffee shop having a cup of coffee, and this young woman walked up to the counter. And she got something out of her purse and she went like this and looked at it. Now, my first instinct, you and I are both old enough that we remember the days, and maybe some women still have it, where they had a compact, you know, a powder compact. And so they would open up that compact and there'd be a little mirror and they'd check their face and then they'd get some powder out and, you know, pat their face with it. And often you would see women of that age do that and look at themselves and go, I look all right. And that was my first instinct because I just saw this mechanism. You know? What she was doing was she had a flip phone and she opened that to see if there were any messages on it. And I just sat there and the first thing I thought was, oh, it's a powder compact. Oh, of course it's not a powder compact. You know, not many people, you don't see much of that these days. But what occurred to me, Con, was, you know, the powder compact was, how do I look? And that was the same with the phone. How do I look? Is anyone looking at me? Am I being seen? Am I the right person? Does someone want me? Am I attractive to the right people? And I just sat there and went, well, there you go. You know, millions of dollars in technology later, and it's the same mechanism. It's the same, you know, we call it social media I sometimes call it anti-social media but I call it social media. You know, it's called social media because we are social creatures and we want to have that connection with people.
Technology is obviously a wonderful thing. Advances over the last, 10 years far exceeded those of the previous 50. And I suggest that the advances that we'll make in the next 5 years will far exceed, those of the last 10. Social media, I guess, from a business perspective, has changed the landscape and certainly what you would do from a training perspective. COVID, obviously, I hate talking about COVID. I'm sure everyone's kind of over it, but it's definitely changed the training landscape.
Yeah.
And is it fair to say that social media and or technology has given you or given trainers in the whole opportunities to continue their work and indeed different types of work that were previously not available?
Absolutely. It's caused problems, but it's also raised opportunities. We do this now, we do training like this. And in the early days of COVID, once everyone rushed around and set up their little home studio with lights and so on, the first thing that you did was to try and get your normal programs back up and running in whatever format. And, you know, a half-day training program, people don't want to do a half-day on Zoom, so you've got to work out how do I break that up.
Yep.
But also it very soon, very quickly, you know, we were all, as you know, we're all trying to figure out how do we do this. And I very quickly realized that it wasn't just how do you do what you do normally but via Zoom. It was also now possible, and I've done this, to Zoom into a meeting at a client's. They might have, you know, one of my clients has a lunch and learn session. So they'll have during lunch, everyone eats their lunch and they learn something.
Yep.
So I provided them with a half an hour recorded thing that they could play during that session. Or I can Zoom in for 10 or 15 minutes. Live interaction. And so, you know, the great thing about all of this is that there's so many opportunities to be of value to people. And I said to one client, they actually said to me, hey, look, because of COVID, we don't think we're going to be able to use you as much as before because we just are not in a position to do what we used to do. And I wrote back and I said, that's perfectly fine. And then I wrote to them another time very soon afterwards and I went, hey, look, I don't want to just be a trainer. I can be a resource. And so that's what it's about. It's about providing your information as a resource through multiple channels in whatever way the client wants. And pretty soon after them saying, we don't know we can use you anymore, they were back using me because we'd all figured out how we can do it differently.
And I'm going to give you a gratuitous plug here, even though you're a guest on my program. I've actually done several of Gary's workshops and the insights that he's provided have been, I wouldn't have thought about them in 20 years, let alone in 5 minutes. So if anybody's looking from a training perspective, whether it's personal or Zoom, you know, whether it's communication training, conflict resolution, I know you're doing a program at the moment with Derek McManus, who was a guest recently with dealing with difficult customers. Free plug there, mate. I think the work that you're doing is the work that you're doing is absolutely outstanding. Gary, it's all fun and games and life is not all beer and Skittles, as we know. I also know you've been very gracious and vulnerable enough to share some of your past experiences with me when we've caught up. I know there was a period back in your life where you did suffer from depression. Would you share, I guess there's always a starting point, I think, where that comes from, how it affected you and how you dealt with it. Now, that's a three-part question, and you've told me off, don't ask multiple-part questions, but I figure if anybody can handle it, Gary can handle it.
A, B, and C. Here we go. Thanks, Con. At one point in my life, I was doing a range of working for a range of clients and working for university, doing some work for the SA police and so on. And I realized I can keep doing this forever. You know, I enjoyed the independence of that. And I thought, I just want to see whether I can do the old work for myself thing, you know. And I've never really been someone who wanted to work for myself, but I enjoyed the independence. And I thought, well, let's see if I can do this. So I kind of gave that away and set up my own business to, you know, go out and do training, speaking, etc., which I've now been doing for about 20 years. So, you know, it's worked along the way. But at the time, I didn't know whether it would. And I'm an introvert by nature. And so I kind of enjoy being home on my own, I don't need to be out with people all the time. But in those early days, I was sitting home. My wife would go to work. I was sitting home on my own all day, every day, trying to create programs, trying to sell them, and you know, trying to interest people in your own ideas. And then you go out every now and then, you get a booking, you go out and you try it out, and it seemed to go okay, but you'd come home and you'd go, did that work, and so on. And even though I'm an introvert and I'm kind of comfortable on my own, being home on your own all day, every day is not good for anyone's mental health. And particularly when you're under the pressure of trying to establish a business at the same time. And so that continued for a couple of years. And then my father died unexpectedly at some point in that early period. And he was of an age, and what he died from was an aneurysm. And so everything that happened to him was kind of statistically normal, but it was still a shock, great shock. And about 12 months after that, I just wasn't coping. It was the grief. It was whatever was going on with my mental health generally. I went to see a psychologist, and you do the little 12-point check. You know, they give you a bit of paper and you tick the boxes. And and he said, yep, you've got moderate depression. And I was actually glad for two reasons, Con. The first reason I was glad was because I thought, well, I'm glad there's something behind it. I'm glad that I've got something that can be dealt with. But the other reason why I was glad, I thought to myself, well, I'm glad I didn't actually tell the truth. Because even though it was just him and me in the room, there was no one else and he was there to help me. It's the usual thing in this area that you don't want to admit how bad things are. So when you score 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, how bad are you? I erred on the side of, no, I'm okay. I didn't want this psychologist who was there only to help me, and I was paying him to help me. I didn't want him to think I was a total loser. And so, you know, I had moderate depression. It might have been severe, but even if it wasn't, it was worse than I said it was. So that affected me probably for about, in broad terms, right from the start, probably about 10 years. I had a friend who was who's a psychologist and very, very helpful to me, gave me, you know, stuff to read, things to do. I ended up going to a different psychologist who also helped me as well. And how it affected me was I would go out and do work, and you couldn't, you know, the usual thing, you couldn't tell that I was depressed, but behind the scenes, I wasn't coping well. I would sleep in way too long. I would stay up way too late. I wouldn't eat healthy foods. I didn't promote myself. I didn't have the confidence to go out and sell myself. I would just do whatever happened. So, you know, your income just sort of flatlines for a while. And so on the surface, everything seemed fine, but I didn't, you know, it drains your energy for anything. And so I didn't have that extra energy to actually go out and market and promote myself. And also you don't have the confidence to do that. And eventually I climbed out of it. I was offered the opportunity to go on antidepressant medication. And I thought about that. I'm not anti-medication. I, you know, had the vaccine and all that kind of thing.
Sure.
But I just thought, I just want to see if I can work my way out of this on my own. My psychologist at the time said, hey, look, if you were my brother, I'd be jumping on you to take some medication. But for some reason, I just went, I just want to see if I can do this, you know. And through a number of techniques and ideas and, you know, the odd book that I read, it was a really, you know, in a sense, it was a very valuable learning experience in how the mind works and how to manage that sort of thought process. And I now talk about it to other people. And one of the things, of course, is we're all much more aware of it. We're all much more tolerant of it. But in workplaces now, people are still worried. If I say I've got a mental health problem, they're still worried what it will mean for them. Mm. And I've spoken in workplaces and I have said to them, because I want them to know that I understand, I've said to them, hey, look, I know that some of you won't speak up about this because you're worried about your job. I get paid to speak up about this. So I am going to speak up on your behalf. Mm. And I think that's a really important thing. And when I said that, I was quite surprised because I had people all around me sort of standing there and the number of people who were nodding their head openly going, yep, yep, that's me, that's what happens, yep.
That's exactly right. A lot of people don't want to admit it for fear of whatever the consequences or retribution may be, whether it's in the workplace or at home.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, having spoken to Nathan Bolton, who just an amazing, amazing man, two tours of duty in Afghanistan and suffered depression and PTSD, he says it's just... he's always had this, he grew up, you know, you're a man, you can't show any signs of weakness. And I'm glad to see, and he acknowledges through his work with Bolton Brothers, that there is the tide is turning, and there is, not that there's more mental health issues, but there's a greater awareness of them, but more people are prepared to actually speak up about it.
Yeah.
And so it's important that, you know, we look to people such as yourself and Nathan and these people, males in particular, who have gone through, as Nathan called it, the black dog, and come out the other side to show and demonstrate that there is hope, there is a way out. It's not a no exit door.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And what I'm fascinated by is what you did in how the way you went about it. Just for the benefit of the listeners and viewers, can you just briefly touch on, I guess, some of the techniques or some of the strategies that you engaged to help you to avoid medication? Because, you know, the old tablet, as you said, your psychologist said, if you were my brother, I'd jump on you to literally shove the pills down your throat.
Yeah.
And we're so quick as a society nowadays, you know, to almost self-medicate. So what strategies can you share?
Yeah. You know, one of the problems, of course, with depression is that, you know, if you've got a sore leg or a broken arm or you don't feel well, you can use your mind to help push you through whatever you need to do. But when it's your mind that's the problem, it's hard to use your brain to fix itself. Mm. And so it's not just about willpower, because your mind is literally not working properly. So a couple of the techniques. One is, and some of these things are very simple and they're just sort of a realization. And one of them is just the idea of the seesaw. The seesaw has a lot of, you know, it's down like this, and down this end are all the bad negative thoughts that you've got. And one of the problems is we focus on those negative thoughts. How do I get rid of them? You know, I don't like these negative thoughts. I want to get rid of them. And so one thing that was just a revelation for me from the psychologist was everyone has negative thoughts of all sorts of different types. Mm. Sometimes they get overwhelming. You don't have to get rid of the negative thoughts. And in fact, the more you focus on getting rid of them, the more you are spending time focusing on negative thoughts. You actually need to just outbalance them. You know, you need to put good stuff on this side. So a large part of the therapy, I guess, that I did was about not just looking on the bright side. It's not just that, but it's doing things in your life that you enjoy that ultimately outweigh the negative things. And I think that's a really valuable tool for people. Mm. The other one was in a book I read, and it said, Imagine in your mind, your mind is like a chessboard, and there are black pieces and white pieces. Okay, and so the white pieces are all the good parts of your life and the good thoughts, and the black pieces are the bad parts. And so I would ask you, Con, and this is a question that they ask you in the book. So which one is you? Are you the white pieces or are you the black pieces? And everyone goes, well, I'm the white pieces because I want to be positive. I want to be happy. And the book says, no, you're both, aren't you? You are both because they're both there in your head. You are the white pieces and the black pieces. And there's a little analogy that, you know, we don't get much mail through a letterbox these days, but when we did, we would get good letters and bad letters. We'd get letters and we'd get junk mail.
And bills.
And bills, that's right. And so, you know, and that was a real revelation for me that you want to be the white pieces all the time, but you are both. Now, the really interesting thing about this, Con, is that's what it says at the beginning of the book. You know, on a chessboard, here are the pieces, and you are actually both of those pieces. And you go, oh, okay, right. Then you get to the end of the book and it says, hey, you know that little analogy about the chessboard and the white pieces and the black pieces? You're not the white pieces or the black pieces. You're the chessboard. And so you are just the surface on which these things happen. You know, using the post office box analogy, you're not the good mail or the bad mail. You're the post office box. Mm-hmm. So your brain is just a thing, and I know this really well now, your brain is just a thing that generates ideas, and it generates good ideas and it generates bad ideas. That's its job. Its mm-hmm. job is to generate your whole heap of ideas. And sometimes for various reasons, it generates lots of really bad ones and you tend to focus on them. But you're the receptacle for these ideas. You are both or you have both, but you're the surface on which these ideas are battling with each other. And so, you know, to realize that they both belong to you, you're the chessboard. You're not either or, you're both, and you are the surface on which this is happening. And part of the techniques that psychologists will teach you is that, you know, when you, and this is a mindfulness technique, you know, if you sit there in mindfulness, if you do meditation, your mind will wander and think about all the different things that are going on in your life, good or bad. And the technique is always just let that thought come into your head and then let it go back out again. In other words, you don't have to grab a hold of it and hang on to it strongly. And that's the same with any sort of depression. You know, it does have a very strong impact on you, so I'm not minimizing it at all. Mm-hmm. But just to have that fundamental realization that these are just ideas and thoughts that come into your head, they are not, in a sense, they're not any more than that. They are just an idea. They are just a thought. And I say this to people in workshops that, some psychologists, if you have anxiety, they'll get you to write the word anxiety 100 times on a piece of paper. And what they're doing is they're saying, look, just get this word out of your head and out into the real world. And it's a strange little word. It's got X's and I's and E's and all sorts, you know. And so it just, the idea is to get a little bit of separation. So between you, here's you, and here's what you have. And this friend of mine who works a lot with children and helping kids to manage their emotions and manage their thoughts, she says to kids, and I wish someone had said this to me when I was little, but I was glad I learnt it older, in managing their thoughts, she says to them, you are the sky and your thoughts are the weather. So the sky is always blue, but the weather comes and goes. And I just think that's a great, you know, that's what our emotions are, that's what our thoughts are.
That's very powerful, very powerful. Yeah. I'm certainly not a psychologist, and before all the psychologists and psychiatrists out there write in and want to roast me over this, I've been on a journey. For those of that know me well, of we'll call it discovery and personal development, probably for the last 12 years. And one of the things that I've learned is, you know, people say, oh, I'm an anxiety sufferer, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. And the power of our language to label ourselves is extremely, extremely powerful. And we have this ability to relate a word and then attach it to ourselves. As you said, that strategy about, you know, writing anxiety on a piece of paper 10 times to create that disassociation. And we definitely for those out there, if you think there's people that only have good thoughts, think again, because they sure as heck don't.
And that idea of labeling crime, you know, that's why these days, and some people say, oh, it's just political correctness or something, or it doesn't matter, but it matters a great deal that, you know, that's why these days we don't tend to refer to disabled people. We talk about people with a disability. You're a person first and you happen to have a disability. Or homeless people, you know, homeless people, a person experiencing homelessness.
Yeah.
So for this period of your life, you are experiencing homelessness. So I was, you know, you can say I was a depressed person, but I was a person experiencing depression.
Yeah, exactly. Gary, I want to go back to, we talk about influence and influence. There's a fine line. We've spoken about it. There's a fine line between manipulation and influence. And I think the easiest way to explain it is influence is kind of good and manipulation is for, you know, Dr. Evil purposes. I read a fascinating book recently, and the gentleman talks about we negotiate every single day, you know, in so many different transactions. People don't see, they don't see that. In fact, one of the things that I do in my workshops, I ask, and I know they're not in sales, I always say to them, how many of you are in sales? And of course, you know, nobody puts a hand up. I go, well, here's the first mistake. You're all in sales because we're selling our ideas. We're selling our proposals, you know, trying to get the kids to go to bed at night. You know, we're selling it to them. How can, from your experience, how can we get that message to be louder for people to understand the importance of being better communicators. And I want to make the point, ladies and gentlemen, communicating isn't being just a speaker. Communicating is listening as well and being a really good listener. How can we, like, at all levels, and I'm talking starting at school, because I see school kids, teenagers, mate, they cannot string two words together, Gary. And I worry for them. How are they going to go on a job interview? How can we, it's almost like a movement here. What do we need to do?
Yeah, and there's a lot of ideas in there, isn't there, that, you know, you and I both know, most people know that talking is not the same as communicating. Talking is not necessarily communicating. Communicating is, I think, not just getting your ideas across. Or the point of communication is not just to get your ideas across. And I say to people, the point of communication is to get the other person to take some sort of action. Now, that's not necessarily pushing them to do something right now, but the action might be, I'm telling you something, I'd like you to remember this because it's useful later on. So, you know, the first thing about communication is to be able to think about, right, what am I doing here? Why am I talking to someone? Now, if you're having a barbecue with your family, well, then the communication is just very low level. You're not trying to achieve anything, really. But in business or in life, you know, the reason why we communicate, like you said, in a job interview, is to get the other person to take some action, which is to think well of you, to make a decision to offer you the job. And I think we need to, you know, as with any communication, there are metaphors, there are ways in which we need to think about communication that help people to do it. I remember, and I use this analogy a lot, I remember years ago, a friend invited me to their place for Boxing Day after Christmas. And so we had a barbecue and they invited the couple from next door, a young couple. And I got to talking to the young guy and he was a professional golfer. He was ranked about number 30 in Australia. So he was pretty good. And I said to him, you know, oh, you must be making a fortune. You know, you're the 30th best. And he said, well, not quite. He said, the people at the top make a lot of money. Even though he's number 30, pretty good golfer, he said, I am just out there battling away trying to make a living. He said, I have no sponsorship except I get one free bag of golf clubs every year. And he said, my wife works one and a bit jobs to support us while I'm out there trying to. And I said to him, you're only 29 away from being number one. What is the difference between you and the number one golfer? And he said, it's really interesting. He said, every golfer that's out there, every decent golfer that's out there on the tour can get the ball from the tee down to the green in about the same number of shots. But getting the ball in the hole is the difference. He says, it takes me 2 to 3 shots every time to get the ball in the hole. It takes the number one golfer 1 or 2 shots. And over the course of a round and a game of golf, that's the difference. Now, I just heard that and I went, that is the best analogy for communication I've ever heard. Everyone gets out there all day, every day. Everyone does what they do. They've got marketing, they've got social media, they do all this sort of stuff. And we all get close to the hole. And part of the work that I do is about helping people to sell, helping them to pitch ideas. I've run a master's program at University of Adelaide on how to pitch for multi-million dollars in funding. How do you get the person to look at you and go, not, I think that's a good idea, but here's the money. How do you get the ball in the hole? Because we can all get very close to the hole. And when you think about it, and I often say it like this, when you think about a golf ball at a hole, Con, that little golf ball sitting there has a lot of potential. It's got the potential to go in the hole. It's got the potential to go everywhere except the hole, right? And there's one pathway that leads to the hole, and there's a million pathways that leads to somewhere else. And so I define communication and influence in sort of two ways. One is about, and this is my work, sometimes it's helping that person get the ball in the hole, how to get the money, how to get the sale, how to actually get this thing done. But the other side of it, I think, is not just influencing someone to do something, but being influential, walking into a room. And you and I both know that in a room of people, there is a conversation going on. And there's a number of possible outcomes, and you may not necessarily have a particular outcome in mind. You're not pushing them to assert, you're not trying to get the ball in the hole, but what you are helping them to do is to create a good outcome for everyone. And so, again, it's kind of that conversation has potential. And I think that's, we need metaphors and analogies like that to help people realize that if you're not getting the results you want, And it usually does, it usually does hit people when they miss out on a job, or something like that. What did I do wrong? What could I have done better? And on my phone, I read a lot of little magazine type stories about, the latest communication stuff. And there's always 100 of them on there, which are about the best thing to say when the job interviewer says, so what are you going to do with your life? Or why do you want to work for us? Or where do you want to be in 5 years time?
Yeah.
So there's always those sort of tricky questions, and being a lawyer and a magician, I'm used to tricky questions. there's always those moments where you've got to say the right thing at the right time. And I think, again, literally being a lawyer and a magician, I learned, the saying the right thing at the right time, the ball goes this way instead of that way.
Gary, we could continue this conversation for another couple of hours, and there's many, many other subjects that I think we could have another episode and have another chat, particularly regarding the PSA. What I do want to say is I just want to touch on the Nevin Award very briefly before we wind up. The Nevin Award is for outstanding service to speakers and the speaking community at large. I've not known you for very long. I've known you probably for about 4 years, I'm guessing 3-4 years. And I know my firsthand experience with the generosity of your time, your experience, and I know what you do from the heart. And personally, I want to thank you for the help that you've given me, but I also know of so many other people that you have helped, and a better recipient or a more deserving recipient of that award, I can't think of one. And again, from everybody within the speaking community, just want to extend a big thank you to you for the work that you do.
Thank you, Tom.
You are an absolute gentleman and a scholar. Ladies and gentlemen, this is
the Nevin Award.
Okay. The second social media version will be the video. So how about you put the Nevin Award? Go and grab him. Go on. Go and grab Nevin. There he is. Ladies and gentlemen, there is the Nevin Award for when you watch the video. Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure this morning. My name is Con. I am the conversationalist. And until next time, bye for now. Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of A Cuppa with a Conversationalist. To join in next time, follow or subscribe. And for more information about my coaching and workshops, visit my website at www.concoutsicus.com.